It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. First, many Muslim Americans experience racism and Islamophobia, especially in the post-9/11 United States. It can be tough to grapple with a sense of identity and belonging in a country that isn't always welcoming. Our next guest shares his story of the challenges and absurdities, the positive moments, and the funny moments, too. Wajahat Ali was born and grew up in California, the child of Pakistani-American immigrant parents. He tries to use humor to cope with discrimination and to tell the story of his experience finding himself in the United States. And he says alongside the challenges, he feels a lot of hope. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or your family had experiences with Islamophobia or racism? What was it like? How do you see Muslim Americans treated in your neck of the woods? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. Wajahat Ali is a playwright, a columnist for the Daily Beast, co-host of the Democracy-ish podcast, and author of the new book, Go Back to Where You Came From, and other helpful recommendations on becoming American. Wajahat, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
You've got no shortage of stories to tell in your life story, from awkward childhood moments to near-death experiences and more. What led you to want to put it all down in memoir-ish form?
Yeah, memoirish. I like that. The story, Go Back to Where You Came From, is about loving a country that doesn't always love you back. And I consider it an elegy for the rest of us who oftentimes are seen as the co-protagonists, sidekicks, villains, or we're completely erased from the story and just treated as footnotes. And I thought in this moment in time, there might be an opening, Rob, where fellow Americans might realize, these people of color, these immigrants, these marginalized folks, they're not lying about this thing called white supremacy and racism. They might be onto something. And all their warnings about our democracy being under attack and the fact that we might not have a multiracial democracy, there might be something here to it. So I thought this was a critical time where I could tell this story, my story, but connect it to the story of America right now, undergoing many atrocities and horrors as we are simultaneously doing this push and pull between nativist trends that have existed and the trend to push and expand this country to accommodate all of our children as its potential co-protagonists. So I thought the time was now.
Your parents laid out three career options for you, as I understand it. Doctor, engineer, or successful businessman. Not just businessman, successful businessman. How did you develop your superpower as a writer and storyteller?
Well, yeah, the fourth option is failure. So you forgot failure.
I forgot failure. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah. That's what I call the immigrant checklist of success. It's not just South Asian parents, but it's basically, hey, we came to this country. We left behind everything. We didn't leave behind everything for you to become an English major. And, you know, we want stability and security for you. And we want the dreams that you can't have. So you have to be a doctor or an engineer or a dubious businessman or a businesswoman who somehow makes a lot of money and he marries well and has 2.1 kids and gets a nice house and gets either a Toyota Acura or a BMW. And, you know, my parents, being Pakistani immigrant parents, very traditional. We always joke that they brought the boat inside the home. Like, they didn't burn the boat. They brought the boat inside the home. First of all, they named me Wajahat, obviously to blend. They didn't teach me English growing up, because who needs English in the Bay Area, California, right? Eh. And they said, you'll learn. But they were very supportive of my artistic talents. So I wrote a story at the age of 10. I mentioned this in the book. And a one-page short story became a 10-page short story. And being this shy, awkward, brown, sweaty kid who wore husky pants, who used to get bullied by his classmates, my teacher said, get up and read this story. And I'm like, please don't make me do it. She goes, get up and do it. And for the first time ever, they were rapt with attention. They didn't mock me. They laughed at all the right parts and they applauded. And that's when I kind of discovered I might have a superhero talent. I might be able to tell a story. And I took that story home to my father, who was drinking chai. He says, beta, which means son, you might have a talent here. You might think about becoming a writer. And my mom ran from the kitchen and said, first become a doctor, which is just insurance, right? My mom was like, just have insurance. But I was very lucky, Rob, that my parents were very untraditional in that they always supported and nurtured the talent. And many children of immigrants don't have that support or that encouragement, and which is why they become doctors and engineers, but secretly very unhappy.
A running theme through the book is, you know, you have a lot of identities, awkward kid, writer, later father. I could go on with that list for a long time. When seen from the outside, especially I think after September 11th, other people, mainly white people, looked at you and saw what?
Osama. Saddam, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, suspect, other, terrorist, potential terrorist, helper of terrorists, potential radical terrorist, who might not be a terrorist. Oh, look, a smiling terrorist. It's very interesting that all of us have complex identities, but oftentimes people are of color are the only ones who are hyphenated or have the asterisks, right? And in 9/11, as I mentioned in the book, for many of us, especially those immigrants, children of immigrants, people of color, who grew up as the model minority stereotype, a stereotype I hope to demolish in the book, you know, we thought we were American, born and raised in this country, right? Yeah, sure, we don't see ourselves on the billboards or on the cover of the magazines, but we are American. We identify. But overnight, after 9/11, all of a sudden we became us and them, you know, a terrorist or a suspect. And overnight from that moment on, me, Wajhat Ali, a Muslim brown kid from California, had to represent and defend 1,400 years of Islamic civilization and 1.8 billion Muslims. And no matter what I did, as Toni Morrison said, that's the exhaustion of racism. It's never enough. You always have to prove your worth, and it's never enough because this nameless judge, jury, and executioner always holds your loyalty, moderation, and patriotism as suspect.
Talking to Wajhat Ali, author of the new book, Go Back to Where You Came From and Other Helpful Recommendations on Becoming American. You can join in with your questions if you'd like at 800-642-1234. If you've experienced some of what Wajhat was just talking about, love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. The title, Go Back to Where You Came From, you write right off the bat, this is something you've heard, been emailed, you're active on social media, you've certainly encountered in there. What do you do with that when somebody, especially in person, when somebody says that to you? I don't know what I would do.
Yeah, you know what's so interesting is the title of the book is like a gut punch, right? And the book begins with emails that I receive every day. And I just copy paste the emails. And the first email is, go back to where you came from. I get it almost every day in some aspect, some form. And it's interesting is that for me, I'm so used to it and people of color are so used to it. But there are many readers in the past month, such as yourself, like, oh my God. This happens to you every day? Wow. How would I respond? And it just shows you how it is for the rest of us who, even though we're born and raised in this country, are told to go back. So it's how you respond. And so how I respond in the book is like Bugs Bunny. You know, Bugs Bunny is chased by Elmer Fudd and Yosemite Sam, but he uses their own traps against them and sometimes kisses them on the cheek. And at the end, he gets the last laugh, the last word, and he gets the carrot. And so I respond by saying, would you like me to go back to the Bay Area? I'd love to if you could subsidize the rent. Or, oh, are we all going back to the womb? Okay, Freud. Or, do you want me to go back to pre-partition India? Because my parents, even my mother wasn't born in India. She was born in Pakistan. And that type of response with some humor is a response, but also kind of dismantles the stupidity and the bigotry of that comment, right? Where apparently the rest of us are here as conditional citizens, and our citizenship and our home loan application and our mortgage can be revoked at any second based upon our ethnicity. And the real American, Rob, apparently the one who was from here, is the white American who, by the way, wasn't from here. It actually belonged to the indigenous Americans, the Native Americans. So it's an ugly sentiment that has been told even to white Americans who weren't once considered white. And if you know your history, I'm talking about Italians, the Irish Catholic, Eastern European Jews, and the Germans. We were all told at one point to go back to where we came from.
Right. But I wonder how you think that, if that's going to change over generations. Like, my family goes back to Poland and Ireland, some other places. You wouldn't know that unless I told you or you did my family, my genealogy or whatever. I just read as white now. You are, you know, second generation, your kids, third generation. Do you worry that because of the skin color difference, that's never going to go away?
Yeah, that's a question I address in the book. You know, that's the test of America. Whether or not America will succeed as a multiracial democracy will be whether or not people like me are considered American or my children are considered American. I'll give you an example. Who's been here since the founding? Black folks. Are they still considered American? Nope, still hyphenated. Latinos? Nope, still hyphenated. Mexicans, indigenous Americans, right? With you and your family, you mentioned Polish and Irish, double whammy, both hated back in the day, but you were able to be absorbed into what I call in the book whiteness. And I'm not talking about white people. With whiteness, it's this paradigm, this structure, this ideology that says those who are considered white or labeled white, which is a social construct, are elevated above all others and are seen as the true inheritors of this country called America, right, where they have the manifest destiny to come birth this country from savagery and bring forth civilizations. But you are able to be absorbed into whiteness because you look, quote unquote, white. Again, a social construct, even though you weren't considered white like 100 years ago. Irish were not considered white. But how about the rest of us who don't look, quote unquote, white, even though we've been here even longer? That's the test, right? That's the test, because Black folks, people of color, will never be absorbed into whiteness ever. So will we dismantle this ideology of supremacy and have true equality? Or will we double down and fight for it and burn the country down? That's the test for the next 20 years.
We're talking to Wajahat Ali about his new book, Go Back to Where You Came From, and other helpful recommendations on becoming American. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with writer and author Wajahat Ali about his new memoir, Go Back to Where You Came From, and other helpful recommendations on becoming American. Wajahat, you think a lot about the portrayal of Pakistani Americans, Muslim Americans in pop culture. I want to take you to a moment. You were younger. Your first kind of breakthrough as a writer was this play you wrote about a Pakistani American family. You're in talks to maybe bring it to L.A., and an agent says, hey, maybe as the Pakistani-American dad, what do you think of Ted Danson?
Yeah, and I laughed, and there was no other laughter on the other end. And I'm like, wait, you're serious? And he said, yeah, Americans like Ted Danson. I'm like, who doesn't like Ted Danson? I love Ted Danson. I love Cheers. I also like Becker. I also saw him in Gulliver's Travels, but this is a story about a Pakistani-American family, and the father, Salman, is a middle-aged Pakistani man who goes, well, think about Ted Danson. And this was, you know, the play, The Domestic Crusaders, I started writing as a senior at UC Berkeley after 9/11 upon the suggestion and recommendation of my teacher, Ishmael Reed, who's a MacArthur Genius winner. And he, as a Black man, said, listen, we've been fighting back for 400 years. Art and culture is how we fight back and tell our stories. Your people, I'm looking at the news right now after 9/11, your people are going to get hazed for 10 years. He was wrong. It's been 20 years. But he said, I've never seen an American story, a kitchen drama story, told from a perspective of, you know, like Muslims or Pakistanis. Write a story like that. And so that story, I had to do it myself, Rob, because I was told 20 years ago, the mainstream will never accept an ethnic story. Translation, white people will not accept a story of brown and Muslim folks. Take away all the ethnic stereotypes and take away all the ethnic mirch and the masala and make it easy and palatable. I proved them wrong. We did it ourselves. And I just want to flex for a moment. This play that was rejected and mocked and ridiculed 6 months ago, 20th anniversary of 9/11, it was republished by McSweeney's with a foreword by Hassan Minhaj and a new conversation between me and Ishmael Reed and Carla Blank. And the play is being taught in schools. The play has been performed around the world. The play is being sold. And so sometimes you just have to do it yourself, have faith in your story, and have faith that the mainstream will come along.
Let's bring on a caller now. Stephanie is with us in Milwaukee. Stephanie, hi.
Hi. I had a comment and also a question. I'm really interested in this topic. I'm a psychology graduate student, and I'm really interested in intersectionality and cultural humility and working with clients. And then just from my experience, I think that it's really helpful to talk about these things, but there are some kind of things that make it difficult for people to talk about it. So my question is, how are some like maybe general ways that can be really good to talk about these things with people, but also with children, because I work with a lot of children, to just talk about this like in a more open way so that we can talk about our different backgrounds, but also talk about difficult kind of topics and how we can talk in a more like inclusive way, including everyone in this conversations that are very important. Thank you.
Stephanie, thanks. A couple big questions there, Wajahat.
Yeah, look, I have three kids. My kids are age 7, 5, and 2, and my wife and I have this conversation all the time, is because you simultaneously want to infuse in them the sense of pride in their culture and their skin color and their tone, especially which is under assault right now in America and their religion. But at the same time, you don't want them to be chauvinists also, right? Or restrictive or reactionary. And we live in a diverse community in Virginia. And so their classmates are different skin tones and different ethnicities and national origins. So what we say is, listen, this is who we are. You know, you're Pakistani American. This is your name. You're Muslim. But listen, at the same time, we live in a country where there's different people, there's different setups, there's different families. And as such, be respectful to everyone. And so what we do is we have had faith in them and their intelligence. So we talk to them. We talk to them at their level. We explain it to them. They're very curious. They understand. I'll give you an example. even during the pandemic, we explained to them, this is why we're doing lockdown. This is why we're doing virtual school. There's a pandemic. This is COVID. This is why we wear masks. This is why we wash our hands. My children, ages 7, 5, and 2, Rob, wear masks, social distance, right? Clean their hands and understand the reason why they're doing it is to protect themselves and other folks. So even when it comes to topics about racism and culture and diversity and colorism, which we have to deal with if you're brown and black, because light skin tone is still the preferred skin tone. And my poor 5-year-old daughter, a couple of months ago, I wrote a New York Times article about this. She looked in the mirror and she said, oh, I wish I was light skin tone. That's beautiful. And I was like, no, everything we've done for 5 years, it's failure. And so we just doubled down and instead, you know, reaffirmed her beauty, her brownness, her brown skin tone, and said there's different colors there. But, you know, you are brown and you're beautiful, just like someone who's white or black is beautiful, but this is who you are. So we have, when you're a brown and black person in this country, you are forced to have these uncomfortable conversations about racism, right, and colorism. And I'll just say that really quickly because oftentimes we're having this conversation, of, oh my God, our children, they can't tolerate these conversations. We have to protect them. I'm like, I was confronted with this at the age of 5 when I was dropped off at preschool and someone said, your skin color is the color of poo. Kids are dealing with this stuff, and it's up to us as parents to actually engage them and give them the right language and the right type of empathy and kindness, and also have faith in them that, listen, you know, this is the world we live in, and these are some of the values that we have, and you can be proud of who you are, but you also have to live in a community of diversity and understand that other folks have different lifestyles as well. And so that's how we've tried to model it. We just go straight in. We talk to them, we treat them with intelligence and sensitivity, and they get it. The kids get it.
Thanks for that call, Stephanie. We're talking to Wajahat Ali. His new book is Go Back to Where You Came From and Other Helpful Recommendations on Becoming American. Wajahat, I hope you don't mind if I spoil the ending a little bit. You come out with a full endorsement of the power of hope. And as a dad, the story you tell to back that up really hit me. Can you share the story of your daughter and how people came together to give you this hope?
Yeah, the last chapter of the book is called Invest in Hope, but Tie Your Camel First, which is based on this beautiful saying in Islam, this, yeah, have faith in God, but tie your camel first, which means do everything within your power to fix your situation. And after you've done that, you know, there's nothing else you can do except have faith. And, you know, having hope is very dangerous oftentimes in hopeless times, because it means exposing yourself to the possibility that when the page turns, it brings a better story. But oftentimes we're met with what? Pain, disappointment, betrayal, regret. And so it's easier to curl up and have your shields go up and be defensive and cynical and apathetic, right? But like I said in the book, that often requires zero investment and means being a spectator. You know, being in the ring of life means exposing yourself to pain. And that was really brought to the forefront with my daughter's diagnosis 3 years ago, where she was diagnosed 8 months before the pandemic with stage 4 liver cancer, all over the liver with a dot, a cancer speck in her lungs. And we're like, we didn't know she'd survive. And we needed a full liver transplant and time was running out. And with the power of storytelling, I shared Nuseiba's story, and over 500 people, mostly strangers, stepped up to potentially be a liver donor for a girl they had never met, including people who told me they hated my politics, but they wanted to save a little girl. And finally, this one anonymous donor who later revealed himself to be Sean Zaheer, who coincidentally lived close by, decided, oh, let me go give a piece of my liver to this little girl. And this little girl survived because a community came together to rally around a little girl who had stage 4 cancer. You know, we raised the funds, raised the word, got an anonymous donor, Sean Zaheer. And now Nuseiba is in the next room, dressed up in one of her many costume changes of the day, Rob, you know, cancer-free, healthy, living her best life. And, you know, she's still immunosuppressed during a pandemic. But, you know, throughout that journey, I imagined what would happen if she passed away, if she prepared myself as a parent, right? Mm-hmm. So I imagined it and I steeled myself with these possibilities. But there was also another narrative where she lived and she lived to be happy and healthy and married and have kids. And I chose to invest in that story.
Do I remember this right? Sean Zaheer, the person who had donated a chunk of liver to your daughter, his question on waking up is, Doc, when can I donate blood next time?
Yeah. Just that was his first question. And the doctor who operated on him, he started crying. He said, listen, I've done this a lot of times. That's the first time I've ever had a donor wake up and ask that question. Usually it's like, when can I get back to work? Am I safe? Am I healthy? But he said, hey, when can I give blood again? Because he's also a marrow and blood donor. And then he told me, he says, you have a good man's liver in your daughter. You have a good man's liver in your daughter. You're very lucky.
And just our last minute, Wajahat, how can we follow his example? I don't know. How can we pick that path of hope and generosity over all the other stuff we know is out there?
In the final minute, I will say this. I often get told, I'm nobody, Waj. And I'm like, some of my favorite people are nobody. I'm a nobody also. I think everyone has a superhero talent. Everyone has something. And the way you behave, the way you model yourself every day in your life, at home, at school, at work, can be a reflection of how you want this country to be. Run for school board. Run for city council. You know, go out to a church. Do interfaith. Give money to the right candidates. In your behavior, in your language, change it up to be more empathetic, more sensitive, and try to model this behavior for your children. Think about how that will impact future generations. At the end of the day, we can only control our own actions and our own intentions. And if we model that behavior, then you know what? That's the best way to go out.
Wajahat, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob, for having me.
Wajahat Ali is a columnist for the Daily Beast. He's a playwright. He was with us sharing his new book. It's called Go Back to Where You Came From and Other Helpful Recommendations on Becoming American. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. That was an archive conversation. Our scheduled Food Friday guest, ironically, after our storm conversation, his power was knocked out by a storm down in Texas or Mexico. I'm not sure where he is. We will hopefully reschedule that conversation about Mexican cooking coming up on a future Food Friday. Coming up after the news, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade today and the federal protection for abortion. We'll talk to a court expert about what went into that ruling, what it means for access in states around the country where these decisions now go. We want to hear from you. What questions or concerns do you have about the future of abortion access and reproductive rights now that Roe v. Wade has been struck down? What does it mean to you to have or not have that choice? What do you want to see happen here in Wisconsin, where as of at least right now, an 1849 law banning all but a few cases of abortion in case of protecting the life of the mother would all be struck down under that law? You can join in that conversation coming up at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. The U.S. Supreme Court this morning released its highly anticipated decision that overturns the constitutional right to an abortion. Upending half a century of precedent from Roe v. Wade, the majority opinion of the court was that states should make their own decisions. Shockwaves were immediately felt here in Wisconsin, where an 1849 law is, at least in theory, now in effect, though legal challenges are likely. Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin CEO Tanya Atkinson said clinics turned away patients today in waiting rooms after the ruling acknowledging abortion now being illegal in the state. President Biden spoke late this morning, calling it a sad day for the country in court. Here's some of what he concluded his speech with.
With this decision, the conservative majority of the Supreme Court shows how extreme it is, how far removed they are from the majority of this country. They made the United States an outlier among developed nations in the world. But this decision must not be the final word.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your reactions to this decision? What's been on your mind today? How are you feeling about it? What do you want to see happen with Wisconsin laws? Observing the 1849 law now on the books and enforceable apparently again? Or do you want action taken in the state legislature to alter that in some way? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Susan Liebel is professor of political science and Warren Research Chair at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia. She teaches courses in political theory and public law, among others. Susan, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be with you, Rob.
What does this mean now? What is the state of the law of the land in the United States and states around the country?
Well, it really depends where you live. And so now what we're looking at is a country that's divided into three types of states. We have states with laws that protect reproductive rights, either in their constitution or by their legislature. So the Northeast, Maine through Maryland, Illinois and Minnesota, Colorado and New Mexico, Washington, Oregon, Nevada, and California. Then we have states with that have what's called trigger laws, laws that will make abortion illegal as soon as the court officially rules, or in the case of Wisconsin, an older law that is still standing. And that will create an abortion desert. We'll see like Texas, Arkansas, Mississippi, Louisiana. It will be difficult to sort of drive out of that area to find access to abortion. And there's more states than that, but I don't want to list them all out for you. And then lastly, there are undecided states, states where we're going to see political actors negotiate. We should be watching Virginia and Florida. Virginia's governor made an announcement this morning asking for a new law. Wisconsin is a state that people are going to be watching as well. And this includes a lot of states, not Michigan, Pennsylvania, Virginia, North Carolina, Florida. So big states, and so we're going to see a very different country with very different rights depending where you live.
Let's talk about what went into this ruling. We had this law in Mississippi. It seemed that Chief Justice Roberts was pulling for a narrower ruling just on that law, and upholding that, there was a 6-3 majority. Then on the decisions of whether to overturn Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, as I understand it, Justice Roberts did not go along with that, so it was a 5-4 decision. What led the court to take this wider approach, overturning those two precedents, as opposed to the narrower approach that Justice Roberts appeared to want?
Well, there's sort of two answers. One is a constitutional law answer, and one's political. And I'll give you the constitutional law answer first, which is that, you know, the court looked at Mississippi's law and said it's constitutional because Roe and Casey were wrongly decided, what they called egregiously wrong. They said women have no right to access abortion that is covered by the U.S. Constitution. They looked at the 14th Amendment's due process clause that protects against being deprived of liberty. And they said liberty doesn't include access to abortion. They looked at the meaning of the word liberty in the context of what Americans believed and what American law covered in 1868 when the 14th Amendment was passed. So Justice Alito dismissed Justice O'Connor's arguments in Casey about bodily integrity and control over reproduction as what she called central to personal dignity and autonomy for women. Instead, Alito said abortion destroys what Roe called potential life, but what the court is now calling unborn human beings. And normally, and you said this, the court doesn't overturn its own rulings, especially ones that are 50 years old. But Alito said that overturning was required because the court had been wrong. And going forward, the court will look only at whether the state's legislation was rational, and it won't subject it to careful scrutiny based on gender or liberty rights. And Justice Roberts' opinion was important. So was Justice Kavanaugh's. So Justice Kavanaugh didn't sign the majority opinion. He used softer language. And he explicitly said that preventing women from traveling to another state to obtain an abortion would be unconstitutional. Justice Roberts was angry, really angry. He agreed that Mississippi's law was constitutional, but for really different reasons. He said, you know, the core holding in Roe and Casey is that women have a right to choose. And he thought 15 weeks gave women time to realize that they were pregnant and make a choice. And he harshly chastised the court majority for overturning precedent, for judicial activism, and for jolting the legal system. And he thought the court should have been more restrained. Just answered the question, is Mississippi law unconstitutional? So this was wider ranging than it needed to be.
Talking to Susan Liebel from St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia, looking at this morning's U.S. Supreme Court ruling overturning Roe v. Wade. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions, your questions. Let's go to your calls now. Bill is with us in Superior. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, I'm in support of the Supreme Court's decision, and I've got 3 points to make about the whole decision. My first point is the Supreme Court didn't ban anything. They can't ban laws. There was never a federal law banning abortion. My second point is it has nothing to do with reproductive rights or reproductive health, because if you're pregnant, obviously the reproduction system's kind of working. And my third point is it has nothing to do with taking equality away from women, because I'm pretty sure it's been illegal for men to kill babies forever, too.
Bill, thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. His first point, Susan, accurate. The Supreme Court isn't banning abortion. It's allowing states to do so if they so wish.
Yes, that's true. I guess what I would say to Bill is points two and three, you know, need a little bit of fleshing out. When you say that women's bodies are working, that makes it seem as if all pregnancies are chosen. And we know that incest and rape are problems in the United States, and that children are the victims of both incest and rape. So when we make statements as radical as what Bill just said, I think we're one, out of step with public opinion in the United States, and two, we're out of step, even if you want to go back to the law, of punishing people for rape, for incest, and for looking at pregnancy in a much more nuanced manner. In terms of equality, I think this is very, very important. Women's bodies and men's bodies are different. And because women carry fetuses, they are subject to choices about employment, health, and finances. And there are superb studies. I would tell people to Google the Turnaway study that show what happens when women don't have access to decide whether or not to expand their families. Most women who seek abortions in America have children, and they are looking to make decisions that are personal about how it is that they will move forward in their lives.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Rita in La Crosse. Rita, hi.
Hi. I'm livid. I cannot understand how they think they have the right to tell a woman what to do with her body. These are decisions that are made in a family between a husband and a wife, and they have no right to do that. They make us second-class citizens again. And when will it end with the rights that they're taking away? I'm just so angry about this. I have grandchildren that should be able to decide what they want to do with their own bodies.
Rita, thanks for the call. Susan?
Rita, your anger was reflected in the dissent written by Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan. They were strident. They accused the court of judicial activism. And they said the word liberty means bodily integrity. It means access to birth control. It means making decisions about how you travel or how you have sex or whom you marry. And for them, like you, the ruling meant women would not be free and equal citizens in the United States. And they used very harsh words about destroying women's autonomy, especially women who don't have enough wealth to travel to another state to obtain an abortion. And I want to underline that, you know, in the case we saw yesterday on guns, the court was saying that we're now going to look at history. And in this case, the dissent was very upset that looking at history in 1868 meant that women wouldn't have rights, because women didn't have the same rights in 1868 as they do now. And they weren't part of the public that passed the 14th Amendment. So I would say read the dissent. I think that you'll see a lot of the arguments that you're making made by the three justices.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Susan Liebel about today's U.S. Supreme Court ruling overturning Roe v. Wade. She's a professor of political science at St. Joseph University. You could join in with your reaction, your question about what happens next, what you want to see happen next, and let us know if this is a voting issue for you one way or another. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk about the Supreme Court ending the what had been viewed as a constitutional right to an abortion in previous decisions. Susan Liebel is with us, chair and professor of political science at St. Joseph's University. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Andrew is with us in Palmyra. Andrew, hi.
Hi, I've got just two quick points. The first point would be regarding the rape and incest argument. People point to this and they say, well, this is why abortion has to be allowed. And my question would be is, if conservatives were to say, okay, rape and incest will allow abortion, however, any other case where it's something that's elective and it's not rape or incest, those are legislated against, would they be okay with that? Secondly, when the argument of it's a woman's body comes up, I'd like to ask, how many fingers, how many toes, how many legs, how many hands does a woman have? Because that's not her body that they're talking about eliminating. That's not her unique set of genetic code that they're talking about ending. So it's not her body that they're going to be eliminating. And I think those are two points that need to be discussed.
Andrew, thanks for the call. Susan, your thoughts?
Well, the implications of what Andrew is raising would mean that we would return to a very different world in which women do not have the same rights to make decisions about their jobs or their social and political worlds that men do. And the implication of what Andrew is saying is that we could also regulate women's pregnancies. If we come to see the fetus as a life that is equal to a woman's, which is, I think, if I understand Andrew correctly, his argument, then we could regulate whether they smoked cigarettes or whether they went to the gym. In other words, the fetus, and Justice Thomas would like to see us go in this direction, would have equal standing with her. I'd also like to point out that not all religions believe what Andrew has just said. So the idea that life begins at conception is a strongly held religious belief by some Americans of some religions. There are other Americans with equally strong held beliefs who are part of religions that require abortion. Judaism is one of those religions that requires a preference for the life of the mother, and for 5,000 years they have held that as their position. So the position that Andrew is suggesting, and that the court may be suggesting, would open up problems for the First Amendment. How would we guarantee the right of different people to exercise their religions?
We're to comment on our online comment section on our website, asking if a pregnant person has a miscarriage, can they get medical help to pass the tissue, or is that also illegal now? They go on, I just got married this month. I'm debating if it's even worth trying to have kids, if the chance of a miscarriage could equal a chance of death with a miscarriage. You were talking about the idea of surveillance and sort of tracking what happens over the course of a pregnancy. I don't think those questions are answered yet, but do you have concerns about the policing of miscarriages?
There's a wonderful book by Renee Kramer that I recommend to the person who wrote in. She writes in a remarkably sophisticated way about how miscarriages may be criminalized and have been criminalized in the past. So the person writing in has an excellent point. Can states legislate criminalize miscarriages? Can they require women to register their pregnancies? This has been suggested as policy, so that as soon as they were pregnant, they would register with the state, and then they would have to justify why they were no longer pregnant. This raises issues that are so far beyond what I think have even been discussed publicly. And, you know, and I also want to underline that overturning Roe and Casey affects all people in the United States, because this decision reaches far beyond abortion to our rights to make choices about how to have sex, whether to access birth control, and whom we can marry. So we really have to think very, very carefully about the implications of saying that people are not free. And I just want to go back to something that was said earlier about the wording of the Constitution. Take a look at the Ninth Amendment. It says that the enumeration, the listing of rights in the Constitution, shouldn't be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. I'm not clear that the framers thought that state legislatures should be dictating whether we can buy birth control or not. I think they were making a list of some rights, but not assuming that those were the only rights that the people had.
Talking to Susan Liebel from St. Joseph's University about the U.S. Supreme Court decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. Back to your calls. Pat is with us in Green Bay. Pat, hi.
Greetings. Bear with me. I'm going to try and pick my words carefully. I don't want to offend anybody, but I am sick and tired of the rich politicians telling the people who put them in office that this is what you are going to do. They've pushed us back, just in the case of Wisconsin, into the 19th century? correct me if I'm wrong, it's ludicrous that somebody that sits in a political office thinks that they have the right to tell a person how they can treat their body.
Pat, thanks for the call, Susan. That gets back to what you're saying about bodily autonomy and whether, and this is kind of core to the argument here, whether the Constitution guarantees that.
I also think Pat has a really, I know Pat's feeling a lot of emotion, and a lot of Americans are feeling emotion on both sides today, and I really want to respect that. But, you know, I think underlying some of Pat's emotion is frustration. You know, most of the American people believe that there should be access to abortion. This decision is so far out of keeping with those ideas that it really puzzles people. And I think that we should understand this decision not as some sort of, oh, this is just the court behaving as it always has. That's not the case. What we're seeing is two things. One, it's the result of minority rule. The six members of the court who oppose abortion are and were put on the court to oppose abortion. There's excellent scholarship in a new book out by Mary Ziegler that explains how it is that donations to the Republican Party led to the appointment of these justices. The Republican Party did not see abortion as part of its policy priorities until it was forced to do so by donations. So what we're seeing is a form of extremism that's out of touch with what Americans feel. But the problem, and I think Pat says this well, is that how would you vote to overturn this? So Justice Alito said women can go out and vote, but actually, and I think people in the state of Wisconsin know this well, gerrymandering, voter suppression, certain rules that place the vote out of reach for some people mean that registering your vote is actually quite difficult. And there's been superb work by Rebecca Kreitzer on how women are systematically excluded from wielding political power. And she documents the different ways in which disproportionate family caretaking responsibilities end up with fewer women running for office. Women are not without electoral or political power, Alito says, but really careful research shows that in fact, in many states, women do not have the power because of party control, gerrymandering, voter suppression, et cetera. So I think that turning to the polls is very important here. And I think that in states like Wisconsin, this will be very interesting to watch because of the kind of divided government that you have.
A tweet here from Reince Priebus of Wisconsin, former Republican National Committee chair, quoting, "True, this decision sends this issue back to states, but due process and constitutional rights begin at conception. That decision is coming next for the Supreme Court. Just our last less than a minute. Do you think we'll see more efforts to restrict abortion coming from the court next?"
If the Republican National Committee gets what was just suggested, with life beginning at conception as the equivalent of living and breathing and walking and thinking women, then we are talking about having a society in which women are, in fact, second-class citizens and in which we revert to a form of patriarchy that Justice O'Connor in Casey spoke to. And I think it's good to remember Justice O'Connor was one of the most conservative justices and a Republican that we saw on the court. But yet, as a woman, as somebody who graduated second in class from Stanford and unable to get a job as a lawyer, she was very conscious of the differences between treatment of men and women in the United States.
Susan, thanks. We'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today. That's Susan Liebel from St. Joseph's University looking at today's U.S. Supreme Court ruling on Roe v. Wade. We'll talk about this more on Monday.